IsraelSin.com.
You're listening to Israel Seen, and I'm Steve.
And this is Yoram, and you're absolutely right. We are listening to Israel Seen. We're even seeing Israel Seen, signing Israel Seen.
We're actually seeing it, for
we
sure.
We are. Well,
we've seen it today.
Yes. One of the reasons I'm so happy to be here, and one of the first things I did when I got here, was I subscribed to the Jerusalem Post, and I get it every single day in the morning. It's waiting for me before coffee.
You're a better man than I am. I almost canceled my subscription. I threatened them.
And I was just going to say that's one of the things we have in common is we both subscribe to the Daily Jerusalem Post. Where in the States, I only got it once a week. So we both read the Post and what's going on in that. And I trump you by once a week buying Haaretz, the Herald Tribune.
Weekend edition.
Weekend edition.
Which
only.
I read most of it online and occasionally by myself.
So what I thought we should do is talk a little bit about the articles we thought most interesting in this last weekend's edition of the papers. Now, I know you keep the Jerusalem Post around as compulsively as I do, and I brought my one copy of Haaretz with me. And
you're going to have a duel?
I thought it might just be fun to talk about the interesting things in the magazines, in the newspapers, and how we react to the ideas that they talk about. I also wanted to mention, for those of our listeners who enjoy what's called here Anglo-Saxon music. There is an event that's used to be once a year in the summer called Jacob's Ladder. Now it's also in the winter. There's a winter event.
It's great.
And this will be the fourth annual winter event. And it consists of musicians from Israel and from abroad who play Anglo-Saxon music, which includes Irish and English and, if there was such a thing, Australian, South African, Scots, British music. It says, and I quote, Irish country folk and world music. They're changing it around a little bit. And there'll be a fellow named Colm Sands from Ireland and the Bodhran Band. Bodhran is an Irish kind of drum. And a group called Forever Young.
Oh, that's a nice name. I like that name.
True. And the Israeli Ethnic Ensemble and the trio Lotem, Diane, Ada, and Marcy.
Where is all of this?
Called Triad. This will be in a kibbutz called Nof Genesar.
Right on the Kinneret.
Which sits right on the Kinneret.
Sea of Galilee.
And, you know, in the summer, it's a nice place, especially because you have the water there to cool down in. In the winter, it should be warm, compared to Jerusalem.
Well, certainly compared to Northern Europe.
And compared to Northern Europe. So these Irish people are really looking forward to being here. And one of the groups that's going to be playing is called the Epstein Family Singers, and we just had a program featuring David Epstein talking about his fundraising activities, and he and his older children are going to be performing, and it should be a lot of fun for those of you who are in the country or who would come here for the sake of this very special event.
What's
the
date? I'm
going to look here and find the date so you can order your plane tickets. December 14th and 15th.
It's around the corner.
So you have some time to come and listen to some fine Irish country folk and world music.
A number of years ago was at Jacob's Ladder.
It's been going for a long time, the summer version. This, as I say, is going to be the fourth time they're doing a winter experience. I haven't been to any of the winter ones. We haven't even been to the summer ones for a long time. But for quite a few years, we'd go the whole gang, which was be like about 10 of us or so.
Wow,
we'd go every year and we'd like make a camp, us and the children and friends and stuff, and it was quite a party. I wanted to mention a few things that were in this last issue of Haaretz in the opinion and comment section. There was an interesting item by the way, this is online, so if the listeners are interested, they could go to haaretz.com. That's the English Haaretz. In Hebrew, it's haaretz.co.il for those of you who would like to read it in the original. And one of these opinion comments was by Tony Bayfield, who is the head of the Movement for Reform Judaism in Great Britain. And he was commenting on how refreshing it was to come to our new president's house, President Shimon Peres, after the experience with Moshe Katsav, who refused to call the head of the American Reform Movement rabbi. He said that every time Shimon Peres called him by his, you know, by his name and title, Rabbi Bayfield, he was really thrilled and felt that there was a real change that had happened, a change for the better. There's also an interesting write by somebody named Marcus Rubin, who is the Jerusalem-based porter for a Dutch newspaper, and he writes about how the real most of the world is becoming more and more globalized, and that there are more and more opportunities for more and more people to live and to learn and to work and to be creative, with the tragic exception of our part of the world here in the Middle East, that certainly much of the Arab world does not seem to be in that flow. Even here in Israel, we are suffering from various kinds of short-sightedness and small thinking when it comes to the openness of our society. Nehemiah Strassler, who's the economics correspondent for Haaretz, writes about hitting Iran in the pocket is the title of his opinion piece. And he mentions that a number of banks have stopped supporting business loans and business transfers to Iran, and that the Iranians have said that their intention, that any bank that stops working with them now will never work with them again.
Oh, that's a heavy threat.
And that they have a long memory. They think of themselves as Persians, which goes back several thousand years. And I thought the most interesting item was the editorial in Haaretz that says essentially that those who were struggling against, who were fighting against sanctions for Iran, are in effect working for a military option against Iran. That, in other words, if the sanctions don't work, and part of the reason they might not work is that there are people who won't maintain them, which I think is part of what happened in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Remember, there was a lot of sympathy and empathy for the poor Iraqis who were suffering under the sanctions. Some countries, Russia particularly, and here again with Iran, it's Russia again, who were not observing the sanctions and made it possible for first Iraq and now for Iran.
And the famous food for oil situation where you had many people within the United Nations themselves making fortunes.
And going back real far, I remember hearing about, I don't have a very clear memory of it, the attempt to put sanctions on Japan of their buying scrap steel from the United States with which to make battleships,
yes,
for
right.
instance. And the scrap steel industry in America was outraged that the government would try and keep them from profiting. And so they continued to sell scrap steel to Japan, who continued to build battleships. And as they say, the rest is history. And I suspect that something like that might have had an influence even on Germany, although I doubt it. But it could have certainly slowed them down had people really taken the issue seriously and gone after them with a strong and serious boycott and economic sanctions. So we're faced with the same story again with Iran and the degree to which people fight those sanctions, which are relatively harmless in terms of killing and destroying people's lives compared to war. It's really quite sad and I think unconscionable that people would work against the sanctions and then complain that, you know, it ends up being a war. I think that there are criminals, there are criminal individuals, and there are criminal countries, criminal governments, and that ways must be devised to stop them or to contain them.
So I would strongly suggest that everybody listening to please do everything in their power to support the sanctions.
Yes.
And with that support, hopefully it will be enough to get Iran to capitulate with the international outrage and somehow rein them in. It doesn't...
That seems...
But however, you know...
Not too likely.
Strange... Well, also
but all
stranger
you can,
things
you
happens.
Try.
If you have all the economic...
You gotta try.
The Iranian leader, Ahmadinejad, was in Albania, and all of a sudden he never finished his extended stay there, left immediately, abruptly, back to Iran to face... tens of thousands of students in protest and want his head on a platter. So there's unrest within Iran even today, and serious enough that he had to go back. So I think putting pressure on Iran economically and socially, as far as international involvement is, if we don't do that, then I think you're right. I think it's a matter of time that there'll be some kind of military intervention, because...
or they will develop their nuclear armament, and then we have a different world.
Hallelujah. That'll be the end of the world as we know it, possibly.
Well, it'll be the beginning of a new era, certainly in the Middle East.
More likely even internationally, because I think the effect is not regional. Even if a bomb lands regionally here, I think there'll be bombs landing all over the place.
I think the ecology, the delicate status of the planet ecologically, does away completely with the option of using nuclear weapons, and which is the reason that I am in favor of Israel ending its nuclear arms program and just calling it quits as far as nuclear arms are concerned, and putting the money that's being spent for that to develop them and to protect them and so on into something that would contribute far more to our real safety and our real well-being.
In principle, that makes all the sense in the world. But at the same time, you know that the psychology in the Middle East is that if you don't have the power and the strength, you're looked as being weak.
Well, I don't even think that there's a situation under which we would even use it, because if we did it as a preemptive strike, I don't think anybody would do that, because it would just put us into such a international political hole of...
No, they're purely defensive.
Unthinkable proportions.
They're purely defensive.
Plus, we'd take a really drastic step on the way to destroying the biosphere. And if we do it as a second strike, then I am of the opinion that there's only really a one strike event here in Israel. We're a small country. I don't remember what, but an enormous percentage of our population lives right here, where we're sitting today in the Tel Aviv coastal plain. And it wouldn't take much to destroy most of the people here. And at that point, I'm not sure what the purpose would be in killing more people somewhere else. It would be too late to stop them from killing us.
Or the fact of just having it and being able to act as a deterrent. I think it's a very real scenario to say, if we know we're getting attacked, that we're going to attack you. We will punish you for this.
I don't think that holds much weight.
I don't know. I think deterrent has held a lot of weight up until this point.
I think the deterrent force we have on the ground of tanks and soldiers and aircraft has far more deterrent weight than a nuclear capability, because they know already how unlikely it is that we would use it. And it is incredibly unlikely that we would actually fire one of these things off. And there would, at that point, be no purpose. I mean, there'd be nothing to say. There wouldn't be anything really to save. There'd be nothing to gain. I don't think we would do it, and I think they know that.
I think knowing that, in fact, we would use it for whatever reasons, whether it made sense or not, that if we were attacked, that they would also be attacked, that there would be retaliation, is enough, unless you're a madman. So I think, though, it's the people on the ground themselves who will push for cautiousness, especially knowing the possibility that they and their families will be destroyed on a second attack. I think it has some legitimacy in terms of deterrence. To what effect, thank God, we don't get to find out right now.
Another item in this week's Haaretz was a review of theater playwright Moti Lerner's work. Lerner has written some very interesting, very critical theater about Israel. I saw two of his plays here actually over the years. One was called Bikvei HaMashiach, In the Footsteps of the Messiah, and I thought it was a very good play. Shown here, must have been in the 80s. Yet the actual events, in a sense, were happening more in the last few years and potentially in the future. And it's a story of a outpost in the Judea Samaria at the moment when Israel and the Palestinians are about to sign a long-term peace commitment. And so we have some spontaneous sound effects which speak to the very subject. Anyway, one of the things I thought was interesting was a quote by Mr. Lerner, and he says, political plays that criticize Israel help the image of the country, claims playwright Moti Lerner, because they present it as an open society, unafraid of internal debate. His controversial works are performed on foreign stages, but rarely at home. And I wrote to Mr. Lerner, and I said that he had made his point very well. He and a number of other playwrights, journalists, and authors have made the statement very powerfully that Israel is a open society and is not afraid of internal debate, and that's enough. I think the point has been well made, and now I think it's time that people like Playwright Lerner and some of the other journalists and authors can write about the struggle that we have to be both an open society and a surviving society, and the conflicts involved in all that, and the degree to which we are succeeding in finding and living in some kind of a balance between these issues. I think that's a much more poignant and a much more legitimate and important point to make.
So come home and do it home.
Come home and appreciate your home.
Yeah.
And I know there were some interesting things in the Post this last week. And really interesting article by Saul Singer. It's the second or third article he's written in the last few months on the subject of conversion. And about, I would describe it as the absurdity of the situation that we've created in discouraging converts, in discouraging people who want to live here and work here and be a part of our society and of our culture. It comes, as he points out, it comes from some very old thinking that is not necessarily Jewish, but we've come to think of it as being Jewish, that we don't look for converts, we don't encourage converts, and it's become a very unuseful, unhelpful, discouraging way of dealing with the question of converts. He points out how, in several of these articles, how much we have to offer, in point of fact, to people who are looking for a spirituality and for a way of life that would be appropriate and complementary to their sensitivities. And that Judaism has a lot to offer to modern man in this context, in the form of Judaism itself, and that we should not be embarrassed, and we should not be shy, and we should go out and tell it like it is, and tell people what we're about and what we have to offer.
Right. So you don't have to be Jewish to be Jewish, but certainly to follow.
Well, that too. But he's talking here more about people who want to come here, who want to live here, who want to contribute to the society, and who would just as well join it in terms of a formal conversion process and formally and legally be a part of our community, and that we have nothing to be ashamed about, and we have no reason to discourage people from joining up with us. There's also an item I see on page one, Steve, if you turn the page back over, about this American comedian woman.
Oh, Sarah Silverman, you mean?
Yeah. Have you ever heard her?
Yes.
Is she funny?
At times. She can be very funny. I like her. She's certainly anti-establishment, and certainly not politically correct, so that's refreshing. But she also can be very juvenile. But really, that she's. I thought for a second she was coming to Israel.
I thought she was here, and she. The article is that she's going to perform a benefit performance for something called the Arava Institute,
right?
Which is an institute in a kibbutz in the Negev. I think it's in Keturah, that deals with desert and research and ecological issues. And I thought she was going to. I thought it was saying that she was going to be performing there at the kibbutz as a fundraiser for the kibbutz, but she's performing in America, where I guess the money is, as a fundraiser for this Desert Research Institute.
Teachers are out on strike for 2 weeks now. You're aware of that, right? I just find it very interesting that really great protests out there to the effect that the kids are home. Not that they like it, but these are high school, I think, and up. And because I saw a lot of kids around. And it doesn't look like it's going to end so fast. And no one quite sure why this is happening, considering that the government pretty much capitulated and agreed to give them a raise in salaries. But there's another thing that was mentioned just recently, and the government has offered Israeli Arabs, young Israeli Arabs, to do alternative service. And from what
you know, what that means?
Yeah, it means that you can, instead of going and doing military service as such, like some of the religious kids do, Shirut Lumi, they can do their time in their own community doing volunteer service under the auspices of the army. once you do that, of course, then you get the full benefits as if you were in the Army, loans, grants, the access to jobs in sensitive areas. And originally, a couple of years ago, when the project pilot project started, it was about 256 took advantage. Last year, 560. And so it's starting to blossom, which is a good sign, until one of the members of Knesset, the Arab members of Knesset today or yesterday, made the statement that we don't want to be Israelified. And if any of our youth decides to pick up and do this, then we're going to ostracize them and throw them out of the community. There were a couple of other Arab organizations, in all fairness, who said we're not about to go that extreme in our approach. But the point being, I find it particularly interesting, is that if there is truly an interest in wanting to be integrated and accepted equally within the community, within this, the country, then one of the major steps would be is to become Israeli with an Arab identity. And apparently the leadership is not willing to do what the Druze have done very successfully in this country, and that's take on an Israeli identity, being a minority in the country. And they're objecting, this same Arab-Israeli group is objecting to the national anthem and objecting to the flag because it's Jewish symbols. And in reality, I think that has to become to an understanding that this is a Jewish state, that which there is Arab minority, but an Arab minority that is fully integrated into the community, into the system. And one way of doing that is participating fully in all avenues of public responsibility. And their leadership, anyway, is really frightened at that possibility, because basically the leadership does not want to integrate, does not want the population to integrate, and is hoping like hell that if Syria can't do it, that Iran will do it and literally throw us out into the sea so they can take back, or they can have the lands that Israel proper sits on. And that's the tragedy, that there is a fifth column within this country. And certainly, I don't even know if it's all the people, but certainly it is the leadership who at times is extraordinarily vocal in their demand for, essentially some kind of elimination of the Jewish state. And I think it's really important for us to, if we believe that we're that this is a Jewish state to stay, that we don't have to apologize for anything about us being uniquely a Jewish state in which there is minorities living that have the same equal rights, but at the same time have to have a responsibility to sign on to the state as it is. And if you don't want to, you certainly are free to leave. But apparently they're not buying into that, at least not at this moment in time. Some are. Some are. And I give all the kavod, all the goodwill, all the good wishes to these young Arab kids who are in fact joining up and volunteering. And really they're being put back into their own communities, so their own communities are directly benefiting from their volunteering, which I thought was really a good policy, a good program. And even with that, it scares the daylights out of the leadership. So that's been now surfacing in a newspaper, surfaced in the Post over the past couple of days. We'll see how that plays out. On the lighter side of events, our basketball team, at least in Tel Aviv, Maccabi Tel Aviv, which has played recently in exhibition games in the NBA and didn't do very well.
Who did they play?
They played, I think, the Nets, and I'm trying to remember who else. But the rules are different there. It's more man-to-man in America. We're more zone defense. We had a couple of our key players who were injured and didn't play. Also, they play longer quarters than we do, than Europe, I think a couple of minutes at least. So there's some serious difficulties. Man-on-man is not a particularly strong effort here in the EuroLeague. We're more zone defense. But we played our first European League game, Maccabi Tel Aviv did, and they won. They beat this young French team, which gave us a run for our money. And we have a beautiful center called the Nokia Center, Yad Eliyahu, it was originally called, which is really a state-of-the-art, beautiful stadium, really perfect for basketball. I mean, you can see from every seat. There isn't a seat that that's blocked. The fans are just wonderful and loyal fans, even when the team isn't doing well. When I'm ready to abandon the team, I'm embarrassed when they say no. You have to applaud them even when they lose, because they're our team. Loyalty is just unbelievable here. But anyway, they did win, and so I think a number of the players, especially some of the American players who came here, were just overwhelmed by the incredible support, vocally and otherwise, for the team. And I think they were so overwhelmed by it, I think that they were not able to find their centers so well and play as a team. But they pulled it out, and so we're on the way to victory.
One on.
Hey, listen, they're my team. I go. That's when I bond with my daughter. She's really into basketball. So together we go. We have really good seats. This is our third season there. So.
And you also had a cultural event this week.
Ah, we did. Thank you. Yes, the 50th anniversary of the Israeli Philharmonic.
No, it's the anniversary
of the Auditorium, right?
The Philharmonic is about closer 70, to 70,
right? 50 years of the place in which it houses the Israeli Philharmonic, which is in Tel Aviv. It was really a treat. They showed a movie that someone had done of the original event 50 years ago, and the person who produced it was that in the auditorium at the time. What a treat. Leonard Bernstein and Isaac Stern and a number of really well-known musicians and entertainers were there. It was quite an amazing thing. And then there was a little clip for a second of Leonard Bernstein with David Ben-Gurion's wife. I thought that was really a precious clip. And, of course, listening to the Philharmonic opening to the state-of-the-art auditorium at the time. And, in fact, I think there were five people for the evening, musicians who had been at the original event, who played for the first, at least the first piece, in the present day group, and I thought that was really exciting and very special moment. So, and of course, our president Shimon Peres was there, as always. Very statesmanlike. I mean, I think being president of this country, he should have been 20 years ago. It's beautiful. He's perfect. He's an absolutely perfect person to be president of the state. And he's very gracious and he's very warm. And people really like him regardless of what the politics are. And he spoke briefly and he was very funny and very sweet as usual. So two big events this past week that I participated in. And the music was extraordinary, of course. As usual. So
I also wanted to mention for upcoming programs, we're going to end this show soon, and we end it with a version of Hatikva played by a fellow named Bruce Berger, who goes by the name Rebbe Soul. And Bruce recently made Aliyah, and we're going to have an interview with him prepared, and we'll listen to some of his other innovative music, and I thought that would be a nice way to end this particular program.
I'm so glad you mentioned it, because I sometimes forget to give him the credit for the piece that he so graciously allows us to use for the show. So thank you.
And I'm very happy that he's here now, because then I can, in all good faith, sell his CD, offer his CD at least, on the CD Israel site. And so we'll go out with Hatikva by Bruce Berger, Rebbe Soul, and invite you all to come visit up with us again for interviews, for comments, for just hanging out with us a little bit.
Yeah, a mellow half hour.
All right.
So this is Steve.
And Yoram.
And we are listening to IsraelScene.com.